A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit www.questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hey everybody, Meg Riley here in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You're here for another episode of The View. Hey, Joanna.
Hello, how is it up there? I mean, this time of year, I feel like we are all in separate countries because it was practically 90 degrees here. One of our regulars, Michael Tino, can't be with us because he's under snowmageddon with a toddler. But what is it like in Minnesota?
Today, it's 10 degrees. Tomorrow, it's going to be 45, which here is balmy. So what this means is, though grateful that there's no such thing as global climate change, but if there were, what it would mean is that things would thaw and freeze and thaw and freeze. So it would be like a giant ice rink and cars would be sailing into each other and people would be falling. But thankfully, there's no such thing as global climate change. It is icy is what I'd say. Yesterday, I skidded through two stop signs. There was just nothing to do but it. And my kid hit a curb with the Prius, which is very, very low. So the bumper smashed it. Yeah, so that's what it's like here. What do you got going on there, Alicia? You got some drama out there with the weather.
Yeah, so since we're talking about the weather, it is going to be a high of 71 today with 76 tomorrow. So welcome summer in February, which is usually our month for snowmageddon, but that's not happening this year.
You should say where you are.
I'm in Colorado, Longmont, Colorado. I have mixed feelings about this very unseasonably warm weather, but it makes for good walks.
And so here I am also in Minnesota and I am loving the sunshine. I was out in Portland, Oregon last year, and the springtime in Portland, I have to say I am missing that because I'm looking back, I'm getting those, where were you 1 year ago reminders on Facebook, and there's flowering trees and the buds are starting to come out. So I am missing springtime in Portland, but the sun in Minnesota beats anything and everything anywhere you are. So I am grateful for the sunshine. Now I'm going to hide myself behind the chalice. I am your tech support person.
It's Terry Bernor on tech with a cool haircut. And today we have with us, I'm excited to say, Reverend Jen Butler. Jen is the CEO of Faith in Public Life in Washington, D.C. It's a strategy center to bring together people of faith across all kinds of lines. Lately, you may have seen Jen with other religious leaders at the Capitol talking about the moral line in the sand around Sessions' confirmation, which I know we are all grieving today, the absolute lack of respect and backbone of the Congress. Let's just leave Trump out of it. The Congress is just appalling. I really honestly feel like they've decided they only represent who they want to represent and not the rest of us. Jen, how is it to be in Washington, D.C. now? You've been there through part of Bush and Obama, and now you're there for Trump. How's it going?
That's a loaded question. It is nuts. At the same time, that what gives me incredible hope right now is the incredible ring of support and solidarity and energy. Not just, here among people really galvanizing to do something about the Trump administration, but around the country. I say, to the people who came in for the Women's March, and I know that's just the start, right? We have to organize all around the country to stop what's happening, for those who are kind of here in the belly of the beast, if you will. It felt like there were reinforcements coming in from Idaho and Michigan and, just like people driving 500 miles and showing that we weren't going to stand for this. You started with, some comments about Sessions. And yes, it's terrifying that, Sessions is going to be the attorney general and that Congress has not shown fully the moral spine that it needed to show. In particular, let's just name it, the Republicans did not show the moral spine that they needed to show. However, when we started, we, the faith community, stood up back in December, following on Steve Bannon's, you know, appointment as chief strategist. It was not totally clear that the Democrats were going to stand firm and oppose Sessions as a gentleman of the Senate. And the Democrats stood firm. And this has been the longest delayed cabinet appointment in presidential history. And it is because the faith community and the progressive community were galvanized in making that happen. But that is something to celebrate. We can make a difference. And we've done that.
Let's do talk about what that means. I would love to talk about what, you know, my staff jokes that in the Bush years in Washington, D.C., it was all about redefining success all the time, right? Because if you define success by what the other people are doing, you never have it. So you're working with William Barber, I know, among other people, in that moral resistance that's coming out of North Carolina. And I know that before the election, Faith in Public Life was moving that North Carolina model to other states. Is that the model that you kind of think is the right one?
Absolutely. If we're going to be able to stop the Trump agenda, we're going to have to focus on the Democrats who need to be shored up to oppose Trump's agenda every step away. We're going to have to focus on those Republicans who are showing moral courage at this moment. And we have seen some of them. We've seen John McCain take them on. We've seen Lindsey Graham. We've seen Lamar Alexander. We've seen Ben Sasse. We need to be encouraging these folks to challenge the unconstitutionality of this refugee ban. We need to challenge what Trump is trying to do with removing sanctions on Russia. There's a whole long list what he's trying to do on LGBT issues and compromising what religious freedom really is. And there are people who, with some added encouragement or pressure, will stand up to Trump, and we need to make that happen. And that is only going to happen in the states. And religious leaders are the key constituency that can make that happen. And so we have to be very vocal on a local level. So what Faith in Public Life is doing is organizing rapid response teams in every state to be able to deploy at a moment's notice and keep up sustained pressure week by week basis. Around Sessions, for example, we had 100 clergy the week before the Sessions voting with in Cleveland and his office and kept sustained pressure on him to vote against Sessions. Now, did the next week, we had 300 faith leaders having a press conference about the refugee ban. And then we had evangelical clergy go and sit down with him yesterday. And they have asked for a monthly meeting with him to explain what reform is needed and why the refugee ban is wrong. And they've been able to secure a commitment to meet with him monthly and talk to him about those policies.
That's fabulous. One of the, I should just say right out, I actually am the founding president of this organization, Faith in Public Life. So I do follow it closely. I'm very proud of it. I'm proud of the work that Jen's been doing. I haven't been on the board for a number of years, but it's a strategic response. And one of the real unique niches that Faith in Public Life has played is to bring progressive evangelicals and Catholics out of the kind of monolith that's often presumed to represent those faiths. I'm especially curious now about the Catholics. I mean, here's the Pope speaking out against the refugee ban in a very popish, prayerful way, but really being clear, I mean, how do you see Catholic voters? Is that making a dent? I know that some of the right-wing television people are now attacking the Pope all the time, but how do you see the Catholic politics at this moment? What do you see as possibility with that?
With Pope Francis resetting the priorities of the church, I think, and also he's been appointing bishops that will emphasize the social justice tradition of the church in the U.S. Over the next couple of years, I think we can expect that the Catholic Church will go back to the Catholic social justice teaching and emphasize the full spectrum of the Catholic teaching. What we had seen in the 80s was that the Catholic Church got more and more politicized and more partisan, basically. And so we're seeing them start to be bold on being the church that is a champion for the poor and for immigrants, it's still quite complex. You know, so I think it depends on what part of the country you are. For example, we saw in Indiana, I guess it was Pence at the time, wanted to issue the Muslim ban. Others were trying to bar, you know, refugees coming from Muslim countries. When Trump spoke to that during his presidential campaign, the bishop, the Catholic, said, "You're going to be doing that over our dead bodies, right? Like, you're not going to do that, Governor Pence." He actually took him on. And so we've seen a number of bishops, that Francis bishops, really being champions. On the other hand, you have some older style bishops who, you know, if you're in Philadelphia, like Chaput there, I think is more conservative leaning and will take up some of the older style issues and be a champion more on conservative issues and emphasize those. And so for example, last week, there was a rumored or a leak that would discriminate religious freedom. The U.S. Catholic Conference put out an email urging the administration to go forward with this discriminatory executive order, basically. So they were championing that quite contested and complicated, trying to move the church for the poor and for the vulnerable to prioritize those issues, able gaze and to focus on these issues of sexuality quite as much on the front lines, you know, to be a hospital for the poor and to really be doing that. But you have some of these older style bishops do is strengthen the Catholic voices that are fighting for social justice, that are really lifting up the social justice tradition of the gospel and trying to. It's interesting that the issue of abortion is one that we try to, you know, build bridges over. If you really want to reduce the number of abortions in this country, we try to find some common ground. Healthcare reform was one area where we found some common ground. If you want to women, then it starts with healthcare. So we were able to make common cause with a lot of association, Catholic sisters, having them be champions on healthcare reform, even at times when the Catholic Bishops Conference was working against us.
Meg, I have some questions for you, because I know that even though I know you're not on the board anymore, I know that you're following along. What would you say are the big differences between when you were doing this before during the Bush years and now? You know, because I think people, you know, on the conservative side, people are trying to do this sort of normalizing of, oh, you know, we had Obama, now it's time for y'all to have Trump. I don't think it's equivalent. What's your take?
Well, I would say that a lot of the agenda of the Republican Party is not that different now than it was during the Bush years. So we had the same attacks on religious freedom, the same attacks on a whole lot of the issues that are going through Congress now. And I think Trump is very, very frightening in a whole lot of ways. I actually think Congress are the people with the power. And the Congress have hardened and calcified even more. There are fewer of them willing to speak on their own with, you know, independence than there were. But a lot of their positions, attacking the poor, attacking the vulnerable, are identical. So I actually, from my lifetime, they started in the Reagan years. I mean, just these whole-scale attacks on women's rights, on reproductive rights, on so the actual content of the fights, I don't feel like is that different. I think people feel a lot freer to go around process now than they did, and that's frightening. I like to think I don't know some of the appoint. I mean, you guys are too young, but Reagan's appointments were just as terrifying as some of Trump's are. I mean, we had a guy who was head of Secretary of the Interior who wanted the end of the world to come, you know. So, I mean, that kind of fundamentalist rigidity has been rising for a number of years. That's one of the things Jen and I share as an obsession with following the history of right-wing politics. I think what's not normal now is the willingness to scrap process, you know. And of course, Trump is this media show where I just heard this today, so it's fresh, that they are literally deciding to make news three times a day to keep people distracted. And while they're doing that, which they're great at, Congress is just rolling out all kinds of voter repression and everything else. And they were doing that. They've just done it consistently and more aggressively. So I should say Faith in Public Life came out of the second victory of Bush W, when the religious community was quite discouraged. And what we felt was that part of the reason that progressive religion never moved anywhere was that everybody was in their little worlds trying to do little things, often with big egos, and that it wasn't really melding into something bigger. So Faith in Public Life often is behind the scenes, like they did all the media for Nuns on the Bus, but it wasn't about them, it was about the nuns on the bus. They do a lot of really strategic figuring out who's the best voice here and how do we elevate that voice. And I think that's actually a great model for all kinds of organizing, where it's about figuring out who here can have the most breadth of credibility and reach. So anyway, you were talking about the Catholics. I'm eager to hear more about that. And also what you see with the evangelical landscape these days.
Yeah, it's interesting, Meg, when we started 10 years ago, we weren't working, it's funny, there were just a lot of divisions between, say, more progressive religious folks, evangelicals, and Catholics, weren't sort of strong relationships and organizational ties. And I'd say over the past 10 years, we've all built those, and those are fraught with tension. We don't all agree on many issues, but we found common cause on environment, on ending torture. Now you dramatically see that of orders on the refugee ban and on immigration. You know, it's just really fascinating to me, and I'm sure y'all have seen this too, and sort of anecdotally, just because we work so much with evangelicals and Catholics, or even in my own life, I mean, I'm from conservative relatives, I'm just struck that when we unleavel letters around the original comments that Trump made that he was going to indeed, you know, do a Muslim ban during the election season, I got comments from conservative relatives who were like, my church settled a Syrian family, and I'm so grateful that you are opposing Trump's position on this. Never before in their life protested, who were emailing me last weekend and saying, where my church settled a Syrian family, and I want to get involved. You know, so I think Trump's action last weekend, or let me say this too, you guys may have seen that outside the National Prayer Breakfast, which is a very conservative event and has been a flashpoint, you know, for those of us, you know, really watching LGBTQ issues, where all the conservatives go often and, you know, pray, you know, with the president. And it's been very frustrating for us to watch, but the folks who go to that decided to stand outside this year and protest rather than be inside at that breakfast and carry signs and pray and protest while the delegates were coming in and while, you know, all the VIPs were coming in. Trump didn't quite realize, you know, that he is radicalizing actually many of his supporters when he takes these kind of extreme actions. He is redrawing coalitional lines. And this is a moment where progressives and folks that were, you know, the evangelicals and Catholics, we've been making common cause on immigration reform for many, many years, drawing us even closer together into new alliances.
So, Jen, this is Alicia, and you, in the very beginning, talked a little bit about the Women's March and the number of folks who showed up there. And I kind of want to go back to that just a little bit, not specifically the march, but the idea of protest as a form of resistance, and ask if there are other specific forms of resistance that people of faith can take from your point of view.
There's so many. I was really struck. I mean, I call Meg Riley often for spiritual support and guidance. I think a lot of our resistance starts with our consumption of media and culture. And the first form of resistance, I think, is not letting Trump and his inside our head and really grounding ourselves and starting with spiritual disciplines to take care of ourselves and our spiritual lives first. Because I think what he's trying to do in his first 100 days is to wear us down and to exhaust us. And I'm so excited about this outpouring of energy and new time activists and people really getting engaged, you know, and so I think we have to be coaching people on how to get themselves ready for a long battle, and then also helping people understand what small victories mean. And we started this conversation with fight the Attorney General position, Jeff Sessions' appointment. We lost, and we knew we were going to lose. We knew he was going to be appointed Attorney General. And because we succeeded in delaying it longer than any other cabinet position in history, what if he had been the Attorney General when the Muslim ban came down? More people would have been killed or harmed. What if he had slid through saying that he would not do some of the things that he said he was going to do? What if Americans did not know how racist he actually is? What if we had not redefined the whole terms, his appointment, and people did not know who Steve Bannon truly was and Jeff Sessions? Faith leaders were out defining Jeff Sessions as the cabinet of bigotry. By the way, the National Council of Churches, time in history, oppose a cabinet position. The Council of Churches, which represents denominations and 45 million people, has never before in its history of the cabinet position. And they actually called Jeff Sessions a white supremacist, which is what he is. What if the truth had not been spoken and had not been named?
Jen, I hear you by implication saying that ministers have a voice in shaping meaning and religious people have a voice in shaping meaning. And so one of the other forms besides being in the streets with that is writing op-eds and speaking publicly and blogging and being really clear with a voice.
I think that's true. So yeah, if we could list them, because I started to go off there and pull out like a list of things. So it's pacing people, and then it's articulating truth, not accommodating this regime, which I think is going to do, numb people. And so we have to be truth tellers, which is what the prophets were. Sometimes we get confused and we think they were trying to tell the future. No, they were telling the truth about the present. And they were telling the truth about the oppression of their moment that they lived in.
That you just said about prophets tell the truth about the present. And in our tradition, when we talk about, you know, how James Luther Adams and how we're all the prophethood of all believers, I mean, this really expands the net into, okay, we are all prophets and we are all here to tell the truth, which, you know, in the last month has become, I think, more pressing and in some ways more ridiculous the need for it than we ever could have imagined.
One of my board members has said that the pulpit is one of the unmediated moments. And we each have a community that we can speak into, whether that's our pulpit or our town square.
So this is just a comment, you know, listening to you, Jen, especially talking about how faith leaders can shape and reclaim and shape the narrative and, you know, just being truth tellers about the present gives me some hope, because I've been really struggling in this era of alternative facts and who claims the story and how the story is told. So, just more than anything, perhaps this is just for everyone, including Jen, is how do we continue to craft a truthful narrative in this era of alternative facts?
It's a really good question. I'm just sitting here thinking about it.
Yeah, because I think that it is perhaps one of the most crucial things that we do right now, but figuring out how to do that in a helpful way so that we're not just repeating the same thing over and over and missing the next thing that's coming. I mean, this has been one of the things that I've seen progressives talk about. I hope we will stop shaming each other for it. You know, we're doing the, oh, you're looking over here when you need to be looking over here. But we also have to, you know, I think take the time and say, the president said this, this is untrue. But figuring out how to give time and energy in the right proportions and to what, I think that's something all of us are struggling with. What do y'all say?
I almost think that talking about what the president says that's not true when has a plan to do it three times a day to keep us angry is playing into their hands. I personally think saying the president will say whatever he wants to say, whether it's true or not, and that is overriding whatever happens today or tomorrow. That has been true through the campaign, it's been through the presidency. And then I'll deny that he said it. So let's not even talk about that. Like that's kind of one of my truths is that, and it comes from having people with the same kind of personality that I've had to deal with in my personal life, that when they say things and then you try to respond, by the time you've responded, they've already either said they didn't say it or they've moved on. And so I've been thinking about this kind of in a new way. I think trying to speak, there are a lot of people obsessed with like, we need to find common cause with the Trump voters. I don't feel that call right now. But I feel like the massive majority of people are overwhelmed, frustrated, and unhappy right now in different ways. And trying to speak the truth of the heart in this time is part of what I think we as religious people can do. Not to ignore that Sessions is a racist and what his policies do and, you know, any of that, but to speak it through the lens of how is it to try to stay human in this. The things are so preposterous that when you even say them back, this used to happen to me when I went out and talked about the religious right decades ago. People would say, that was really hateful what you said. That's because I was quoting hateful people. I wasn't saying hateful, but because I was quoting them, people would tell me I sounded hateful. And so I don't know. I think it's tricky to quote things that are just untrue and weird, and it in a way gives them more power. I don't know, Jen, I'm curious what you think. You guys work on messaging a lot there.
I think that's true. We did some message testing before the election, which obviously didn't go so well. I mean, what we discovered was conversations have to start with listening to what people's fears and concerns are and acknowledging those fears and concerns because they're real and they're valid. Whatever people are experiencing, we know this from psychology, right? Like they're experiencing pain. They've lost their jobs. He spoke articulately actually to that. His campaign had an answer to that. Whatever that fear is, I think, you know, it's like, I hear what you're saying. You're concerned about right now. Well, let's talk about that and let's unpack that. And what are the answers? How can we feel more secure to be able to have conversations and not talk about things that the president has said, but to be able to really do that in a community setting where lots of people are sharing their perspective in a home-measured way?
I think one of the gifts that we have is that we don't have to support either party, you know, that we're not party hacks. I remember Jim Wallace said at the meeting where we founded Faith in Public Life, he said progressive religion wasn't on the ballot, you know, and that's always true, that it's not. Our values might be better represented by one candidate than another, but we are not, that's not our job to promote candidates or a party. And so I think that gives me the ability to say, we were in trouble before the election. We were in big trouble. You know, a lot of these problems were huge problems before the election. Who's the president and even the Congress that can't solve some of these problems? They can make them worse, but you know, to not have to defend Hillary or the Democrats or that is a real freedom that a lot of people don't have. That I personally think is really important that we, you know, I'm grateful that both of my senators vote in ways that I generally like. I'm not working for them. You know, I don't need to, my primary loyalty is to the truth, the prophetic truth and the truth through love. And that's a huge gift, I think, that we have that a lot of people don't in a lot of worlds.
Well, it just brings in a question for me. So if we are able to perhaps transcend the polarity between Democrats and Republicans, is it opening up perhaps a conversation about what the bigger picture questions about what democracy means and what the Constitution really is, and almost like a civics 101 for the country? Is that the opportunity that we have at this time to really dive into that? And do people actually have the ability to do that and care to do that is a question that I have.
I think there's a real hunger among people for that and for community. And I think that be out there are actually trying to destroy that at the core. Poll, for example, the attack on media that began decades ago, and even some conservative pundits have turned around and said, we did a disservice to this country because we started attacking it all. It was all biased. Authoritarian leader has stepped in and taken advantage of that and is attacking all of us. I think people are truly hungry for a reclamation of democracy. To reclaim this country right now has to take on both parties. And it has to begin with a moral vision, of course, that includes everybody for what this country really ought to be, our civic culture and our democracy.
I'm seeing a lot of hunger for that here. Meg Barnhouse, I'm starting to believe that if your name is Meg, then you automatically are brilliant, has looked at, you know, how we have OWL for giving comprehensive sexuality education, and is saying, well, I think we now need a version of that for civics and for all ages, maybe especially for adults. And so she's looking at putting something together, having good old-fashioned civics professors come in and teach all of us these things, because they don't teach that anymore. There's no such thing as, you know, you have your history classes and stuff like that, but they don't have actual civics classes anymore. And so, you know, we use, okay, we've done it with sex ed, so now maybe it's time for us to do it with education about the government and about the system.
Jennifer, I'm going to switch the subject a little bit. You mentioned earlier the Johnson Amendment, which the president has said he wants to get rid of. He wants churches to be able to get money and promote candidates with it and do all kinds of stuff. Where do you see that going? What's up with that? How do different communities respond to that that you interact with?
To be clear, churches already have the ability to weigh in with their values in public life. Of course, wants to remove the Johnson Amendment, which it prevents churches from being able to endorse candidates, prevents them from being able to take tax-deductible contributions and siphoning them off and giving them to candidates. So what that would do is bring politics directly into the church. It would enable politicians to essentially buy off churches. I think it's extremely dangerous. And I think it's part of this effort to undermine fundamentally the institutions that have made our democracy strong. In the same way, you know, these forces have undermined our media and are now, you know, have polarized Congress by buying it off. They now want to buy off religious institutions. On first glance, sound really good to some religious institutions. American churches, for example, somebody was explaining to me that the IRS, to some Black church leaders, that, you know, a couple of them, the IRS had gone after because they are very active, given their civil rights history and a long history of oppression. They organized through their churches to turn voters out. IRS had gone after some churches. And so it can sort of seem good, like, oh, we won't have to worry about these politically motivated attacks and investigations from the IRS anymore if we remove the Johnson Amendment. And so it can look kind of good. Oh, good, we'll be free and we don't have to worry about that. But what it would do, obviously, is polarize our pews even further and politicize us. And it's just a cynically motivated attempt to hand to conservative churches. And we all know they'd be far more armed than the progressive side. So it's very dangerous and we'll be out there opposing it.
And what about the religious liberty bill that is kicking around? We keep seeing drafts of it, the one that you think Congress is going to try to pass that?
Yeah. So that was supposed to be introduced last week. And, you know, so far as we understand, Ivanka Trump and Jared intervened. There probably will be some attempt to deliver to their religious right constituency. There'll be some attempt to pass the order or legislation that discriminates against LGBTQ people, religious freedom. We are on the watch and the lookout for that. We have a campaign running right now to ensure that religious communities say, you know, that's despicable. Don't use religious freedom, not in our name.
Sorry, can you be more specific? I started midway through this conversation. Yeah. Can you describe the so-called religious liberty bill?
We've seen this sort of the past couple of years, actually, that conservatives have been trying to pass even state legislation that says that basically it's this idea that if you're a Christian business, you shouldn't have to bake a cake for a gay couple, or if you are a pastor, you shouldn't be forced to perform a gay wedding. A lot of these are just red herrings. Like, pastors are already protected. They don't have to perform gay weddings. They're already their free speech and their freedom of religion is already protected. Where across a line is that, you know, businesses are in the public square. You know, if you go back to the civil rights movement in the South, a lot of people said, it's my religious right. I believe that Blacks are inferior to whites, and therefore my restaurant should not have to serve Blacks. You know, so at some point we have to balance religious freedoms, and we can't discriminate in the name of religious freedom. We have to balance religious freedoms and personal rights. And so basically what conservatives are trying to do is say, well, you know, my religious freedom is compromised when you tell me that I have to respect LGBTQ rights. That is actually violating religious freedom. Religious freedom doesn't give anybody the right to discriminate. So the executive order that they had drafted did not perform that balancing act of balancing those two important rights that are guaranteed in our Constitution.
You know, years ago, here's an old lady story, but years ago I was in D.C. when they were drafting the religious freedom. And I remember Urvashi Vaid, who then ran the National Gay Lesbian Task Force, got into a dramatic fight with David Saperstein from the Religious Action Center of Reformed Judaism. He was for it. She was against it. And she was saying religious freedom will be the next, both of them lawyers, you know, arguing all these legal precedents, that religious freedom will be the next way that gay rights are attacked, you know? And I think about that because he was like, oh, come on, you know? And then he was like, without it, religions will be attacked. You know, it's just really, and I was in that coalition and it was this no carve outs left to right coalition. It was probably the hardest coalitional meetings I ever went to because all of us wanted carve outs for our fears about how it would be religious freedom could be used. And the rule in the room was no carve outs, which meant like, no, you can't exempt this group or that group or the other group. And everybody had our pet that we thought should be exempted. And God, I would go be so tired from that meetings. But we did find a way to balance by saying nobody was exempted. And now this is a total, you know, that the left who gave on our desired carve outs for people like prisoners and others that we really wanted to protect. You know, I'm kind of thinking of Urvashi Vaid, thinking, well, maybe she was kind of right about this, but it's later. It did some good.
I think, you know, she was really prescient in that, that legislation, which was called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, I think. What has happened is that conservatives are taking that, implement it state by state, and they take that original language and they adulterate it, take those very important legal words out that are so critical, leave big holes in it that a truck could drive through to discriminate. What they did with this executive order, they wrote it in such a way, actually discriminate against my faith. My faith tells me that LGBTQ people are created in the image of God.
Yeah, I wondered about that. Like if that passed, could UU churches, you know, how far could that go with religious freedom? I mean, I joked on Facebook, like could a waitress refuse to serve a sexist jerk and say, sexism's against my religion, buddy, go get your own dinner, you know? I mean, like how far could you go with that? I don't know. It certainly isn't designed to stop oppression, but could it be turned on it, people? Because oppression is against our religion.
And I think that's folks are making now that religious freedom is meant to protect houses of worship on this road of saying that Hobby Lobby is supposed to have the standing of a congregation or a place of worship in really muddy waters. That doesn't work because a business has to serve the public, can't have public places like that have the right to discriminate against. Everybody needs to be treated with equal standing. We can't be discriminating in employment and other things. It harkens back to the civil rights movement and some of the basic things that we fought there.
So I'm going to change the subject again. You have been lifting up economic concerns for a long time. That's been your kind of private passion in the whole landscape. And I'm betting because of that, that the election and some of the language around it was particularly painful for you because it economic issues have not gotten the attention that and some of the people suffering haven't. I've been really perplexed because, you know, the average Trump voter made more than the average Hillary voter. The average Trump voter was not the disenfranchised rural coal miner at all. They were suburban white men, but who were doing better than they were 8 years ago. But at least those are the numbers I've seen. But this little group of non-voters came in and kind of tipped the balance. What role do you think religion or congregations could play in speaking to those groups. As you said, Trump spoke to them very well. He spoke to their fears. He might have promised things that he won't deliver, but he did acknowledge their fears really well. I'm thinking particularly of rural congregations. What do you think that they have to offer at this point, and what could the rest of us learn from rural congregations?
Really cool if congregations could get together and have a conversation about that. We do a lot of work in Ohio. There's actually a bipartisan coalition of states who are going to put forward a piece of legislation. And so we're going to build a coalition of churches that are going to help make sure that that happens. In urban churches, we're having a dialogue over situation and connecting up with one another and really listening to each other's economic interests and building a power base, which, you know, it's part of that rust belt where the cities are falling apart, but also you have the coal mining need a movement for economic change in that state. What if the faith community helped come up with the solutions? Now, the solutions are not easy, obviously, because jobs through technological advances, we're losing jobs through trade agreements. But I also think that a lot of political will and capital has not on coming up with the solutions.
I think it's really complicated. I mean, I spent some of my sabbatical in rural Missouri and, you know, went to the town that my ancestors helped to found. And it's just broken down houses. There isn't a single business there. I mean, it just was sad. It just was really sad to me. I thought I'd hang out in a diner and just listen to people talk. So I saw a person and said, is there a diner? And they were like, there's a McDonald's out on the highway, you know, and that was it. And I thought, how are people, and I didn't see any churches. I just thought that were still functional. There were some old broken down ones, but I just thought, like, how are people gathering in any kind of way? You know, how is it all happening? I don't know. I don't know where it's happening. Trying to make something that can work at all it's interesting. It's a challenge.
It is. It's overwhelming when you realize that those communities really fell apart to that degree, that there's not even a church institution left. And to me, that like people were promised a retirement and now that retirement, like how can you, that was part of your payment package. And we hear of this so often that people's retirement is suddenly gone. That was part of their pay. Now it's gone. They depended on that and it was revoked. I'm glad we can work to defend that and to get that back. And we'll see where that goes. That's a bit of something churches can do. There's some areas we can't save, but there may be some areas we can.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that. I mean, I love hearing that you're doing a state strategy now, because I think I've been thinking about people like Joanna and me who are in or near capitals, and what particular, you know, there are interfaith coalitions everywhere, of course, but many of them either focus on one thing because they're run by a community organizing group that's super focused, or they don't focus on anything. I mean, I don't know of a lot of the kinds that are actually agile and responsive the way you're describing, that have kind of a SWAT team ready to go. So that I'm excited to hear about that, because I mean, I went to a briefing the other night and it was like somebody talking about a bill that isn't even going to be introduced. And meanwhile, we're fighting off these ridiculous bills here. And I was like, just because that's what you work on, it doesn't mean it's what 50 people need to talk about right now. It's very frustrating. I felt that in DC too. The faith community was the only community that wasn't organized by issue. It was the only overarching, we care about humanity, the earth, life itself, kind of, that was our charge. So I feel like we have a really special role to play.
Yeah, I love that we can be nimble like that. I mean, sometimes it can feel a little overwhelming because we have to know everything about everything, but we have a database now of 40,000 leaders spread all over the country. And so we can, SWAT team is a great analogy, even though it's a little militant. We can be like, okay, you guys in Nebraska, go, you know? And people love that because, and they're like, oh, I want to do something, but I have 3 funerals this week. And, you know, and so we can call on them and say, for now, press conference, can you do it? We'll put it together. It's a lot of fun.
I'm glad it's still a lot of fun. Thank you so much for being with us. And really, I honestly do pray for all the people in the Beltway. I know that it's a very particular culture to live and work in. So my prayers are with you all daily and all your good staff who does such good work, and all of the people working all over the country. But that's really the belly of the beast there in DC. We have Black Lives of UU coming with us next week to catch us up on, I'm sure, getting ready for the convening that they're going to hold in New Orleans in mid-March. And we look forward to that.
Thanks for joining us, Jen.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jen.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.